You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Davidson Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chat with Philip Heltevig. He's the co-founder of Cognigy, which was sold to Nice in 2025, just in September, so not that long ago. He's now the chief AI officer there. Now, I chatted with him on the different developments of AI across since when ChatGPT was founded three and a half years ago to now, the way agentic AI has developed in contrast to, say, chatbots, digital assistants, whatever you want to call them, as well as the impact it has on industries that up until recently were very human-led. If we're talking about customer service, is it replacing humans? And we really kind of get into the meat of the moral question of how AI is impacting the job market, development, really the human race in total. He also spoke about the transition between being a founder to then kind of entering a larger organization. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Okay, Philip, thank you very much for coming on the EU Startups podcast. It's great to have you.
Yeah, great. Great to be here. Thanks.
No, of course. I'm excited for this episode. Really, you know, I'm not somebody who has a background in AI at all. So you might feel like you're kind of chatting with a Neanderthal, but I'm going to do my best to keep up with you. And I am interested in kind of, you know, hearing a lot of the, the background, the technical detail that I think, you know, sometimes kind of gets lost, especially when we're reporting, you know, on funding rounds, everything's so AI focused now. So I think it's good to kind of get your background in on all of this. So I was thinking, before we start, as usual, I give guests a chance to introduce themselves. They can do it better than I can. So why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sounds great. Hi, everyone. My name is Phil. I was one of the co-founders of Cognigy, which has last year been acquired by Nice. So now we're Nice Cognigy. And what we do is we're doing AI agents and agentic enablement for customer experience. So we are working with the who is who around the world, big companies like Sony, like Allianz, like Lufthansa, like Nationwide, etc., in automating their customer service, sales and marketing operations with agentic AI. And that's what we do. And happy to be here and talk about that today.
Great. Yes. Well, it's as some may know, so you were founded in 2016. And I think really what's an important question to always be asking anybody who comes on the show and really any founder, in my opinion, is at what point did you see a gap, a problem, and what made you think that you had the ability, the ideas to address it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was actually with us. It was a bit of a funny story because when we initially met, we had a completely different idea to what we're doing now. So we met, and so my co-founder Sasha, he contacted me out of the blue. I didn't know him at the time, and he said he's going to move to Düsseldorf, where we're based here in Germany, and he wanted to meet with some people at a network. just show his idea and maybe get input, because he wanted to found a startup. And I was just exiting my prior company at the time. And I thought, yeah, why not? A great idea. Let's meet. And so we met, and maybe you know or not, Düsseldorf has the largest Japanese expat community in Europe. So we have a little Japan town, and that's, of course, where we met. We had a lunch, and he said to me, he said something to me that really stuck with me. He said, we're now entering a world where humans will be able to communicate with machines just like they're communicating with other humans. And I thought, I never really thought about that. I mean, I was in the web industry at that time, so web content management. And I thought, that sounds really enticing. That sounds interesting. That sounds sci-fi, right? So let's build something. And so we threw all these ideas around, and we did SWOT analysis for all these ideas, and we settled on building a speaking teddy bear. And the reason why the teddy bear is really because we thought the tech is going to be great, but it's not that great yet. So we need to find a use case where the target audience is rather forgiving. And children can be rather forgiving, right? If a child says to the teddy bear, hey, let's play the word game, and the teddy bear goes like, oh, yes, I love green apples, then it doesn't make any sense, but a kid would just laugh and have fun, right? So we thought that that could be good. And so we had the idea, of course, we weren't just going to build the bear. We were going to build the bear and then later on a speaking Barbie and Yoda and Stormtroopers and whatever. So we built this amazing toy empire with speaking toys. And so what we needed is we needed an AI system that non-technical users could use and craft these conversations. Because I guess we can all agree that, I mean, I'm an engineer, and probably the majority of engineers are not experts in creating conversational experiences for children. So we would have these experts, but they would need a tool set that they can use to create these types of experiences for the children. And so we thought we would just use one that's out there. We never thought we were going to build an AI system. We thought we would just pick IBM Watson because it's the best AI in the world, and it'll all work out. And then we looked into it, and we found that it was very disappointing. It was not at all what the ads would show. And if you look at the ads on YouTube from IBM Watson, if they haven't taken them down, from 2016, it's literally like talking about flying cars, right? I mean, it has nothing to do with reality. And so we locked in, we tried it out, and we were very disillusioned in a way. And then we thought, okay, there must be something else. So let's log into another one, which is called API.ai at the time, which then was acquired by Google a little bit later. That was similarly disappointing. And so we thought, okay, there really is a gap in the market for a platform that lets you build conversations in a graphical way. You had to be a developer at that time to do that. And so that's the gap we saw. And then we, I guess as a startup founder, you have to say we pivoted. The pivot is very important. But it's really more like flexibility, right? And so we were flexible in looking at, okay, how can we drive this further? And then we said, okay, you know what? The platform that we need to empower these users to create conversations for the bear doesn't exist. So we're just going to be building it ourselves. And that's what we then did. We picked a number of use cases of what you can do with it. The bear went on the shelf. We very quickly went into customer service because this is where true ROI was. There was a lot of frustrations. A lot of enterprises were still stuck with brittle IVR systems and really badly performing chatbots at the time, which didn't really deserve the name. And so we wanted to build a tool set that allowed enterprises to really grow into that vision of, we now live in an era where we can communicate with computers just like with other humans. And it's funny because like our holy grail was always the Star Trek computer, right? From like the next generation.
Sure.
Jean-Luc Picard speaking to the computer. If you listen to the voice models that exist now, so the new NVIDIA models, or also even ChatGPT Advanced Voice or Gemini Voice, these have far surpassed the Star Trek vision already, right? Like we can communicate with these AIs completely fluently, like we would with other humans. The stuff that they're able to do is just crazy, and it's getting crazier by the day. So this future vision that Sasha painted to me in that restaurant has become reality, not just for Cognigy, but for us as humans. So it's been a really exciting journey.
I didn't know that. And I'd done my research, obviously, before this interview, but the whole teddy bear story, I hadn't seen that. That's great. And you know, this topic here, talking about pivoting, as you yourself identified, is essential. And it kind of leads me to the next question that I want to get into, which is, you came on our radar, if I'm looking back at our catalog, you came on our radar, your Series B, which if I have my notes right, Series B, 36 million, 2021. Then you had a Series C, 93 million in 2024. So what that makes me curious is, because by 2021, you're at your Series B, and at that point you're established, you're bringing in, a good amount of funding. And I'm curious to hear, because if we're talking 2021, that's kind of a middle ground between founding and when you were eventually acquired. And I'm curious to hear about how you felt Cognigy was doing at that point. If you still felt there were things that you need to iron out, because there's a lot of founders I talk to where they have a lot of difficulty identifying what they should prioritize in the launch and in the beginning years, and what things they can leave maybe towards later that can be ironed out. So I'm curious to hear about where you saw the company at that point.
I think in general, up to the up to a Series B, you are probably in the business of finding a really good product market fit and a product that can be sold in a repetitive motion, right? By 2021, we had found that. We knew what our market was. It was large enterprises that had very specific requirements for this type of software: scalability, security, governance, et cetera, et cetera. So this whole enterprise ops thing, we had all of that figured out. We were a market leader. We were in Gartner Magic Quadrant, Gartner Cool Vendors Report, etc. So I think we had that figured out. But a lot of startups actually have that figured out. What a lot of technical startups startup founders disregard, maybe out of a kind of technical arrogance, where you go like, business is easy, technology is hard. It's actually the other way around. Right. Technology, especially nowadays with vibe coding and all that, technology is easy. GTM, so go to market. Building that machine that can create a predictable large number of high quality leads, qualifying those leads, going through the sales process, selling to the customer, and working with the customer afterwards to actually implement your solution and get value out of that. That is the machinery that you really have to build from the Series B onwards. I mean, hopefully you have some of that in place prior to the Series B. And it was the same with us. In the early years of a startup, you engage mostly in what's called founder-led sales. As in, you are in all the, as a founder or with us, a founder team, you're in all the large deals. You're in all deals at the beginning because you're the only salesperson, right? And then you are in the larger deals, et cetera. And as you scale out of a Series B, I mean, we had teams in many countries around the world, in the US, in Europe, in APAC, in Australia. You need to build a team that can be enabled to run all of this on their own, so that the founder is no longer required in the sales process. And that really is the thing that really, with a Series B, you get the funds to actually build a machine like that. And so that is what we've been doing.
And is the eventual acquisition, do you see that as a validation of the work you achieved up until that point? What was that kind of moment like when we're talking about the founder journey?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? Because every founder, or first time or second time founder, has this dream of being acquired, right? And dream of making a lot of money. And of course that's nice, but it's really, as with so many things in life, I think afterwards you see that it's really the journey that was the most fun. then you get acquired, and luckily with us, the journey is continuing. So it is actually still a lot of fun. But I think for many startup founders, they get acquired and they kind of fall into this hole and go like, okay, what now? Mm-hmm. Now, it is, of course, it is a massive validation, right? If someone is willing to pay $1 billion for you, for the company that you've built, then this means you've built something of real value, and something that has also received that recognition in the market. And for us, this was, I think it was the exact right moment, because again, I mean, we just spoke about the GTM motion, right? So from the Series B, you build up sales teams, you build pre-sales teams, you build enablement, you build customer success functions, you build a repetitive or repeatable professional services motion to implement your software, et cetera, et cetera. But you're always resource, very resource constrained in a startup. I mean, even if you get $35 million in funding, I mean, compared to the company where I work now, I mean, NICE makes $1 billion in profit a year, right? So $35 million in funding is not a lot of funding. it looks like this when you've never received that much funding, but in the end, it doesn't. And of course, now we can scale this at a completely different level. We have thousands of salespeople. We have thousands and thousands of engineers at our disposal to drive this vision forward, right? So it's really, it can be a very positive event when you get acquired on a personal level, but it can also be a very positive event on a professional level. And I think with us, the stars really aligned. I mean, I think we were in acquisition conversations probably around 10 times during our journey, but it never really fit, right? Either the offers weren't good enough, or we didn't feel it was a good fit from a company perspective. And also NICE approached us several times throughout the years, and only in the end it really fit. And that was the most important thing for us. It was not just the money, because we could have probably kept going and sold for an even higher amount. But it was really that we felt it's the right decision for the company and it's the right decision for the people. Because, of course, you build a very close-knit team when you build a startup like Cognigy, and you want to see that continuing.
Sure. And as you shifted into kind of a different role as well, because I think that must have come with its own kind of challenge, because you're chief AI officer now at NICE Cognigy, and I imagine your focus must have shifted as well. Did that go into something that you found to be new, more thrilling, or did you feel such an easy complementary role to what you had before as founder?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to cite Scott Russell, the CEO of NICE. We had, of course, many discussions during the acquisition phase. And in one discussion, he said to me, "Phil, I want you to know that we don't want you to become NICE. We want NICE to become more like Cognigy." And so he said, "I'm going to do everything in my power to enable you to help make that happen." So we are not a little sub-business unit inside of NICE, but we are really, together with the wider team at NICE, building the future of NICE and building the future of AI in customer experience. So in that sense, I guess our experience of being acquired might be different to many others, where you're not being acquired and being slotted into this little corner office somewhere. But we are really actively shaping the future of this company. We have a lot of freedom in how we are doing that. We are surrounded by amazing people, and people who know me know that I wouldn't say that if it weren't true, right? But I was actually surprised of the quality of people and the motivation to actually move such a big company like NICE into the next century. And it's so for me personally, not that much has changed. Sure, I now have a boss that's new. And I need to sometimes, when I want to allocate someone extra equity or increase someone's salary above the normal and merit increase percentage, then I have to go talk to my boss about it. So that's new. But it could be worse, to be honest. So we have a lot of autonomy. We've retained a lot of autonomy here at NICE. And I think that's really good for us, because I think otherwise we would lose a lot of people. Because when you come from a startup, you're used to a different level of autonomy. And it's also good for NICE, because we're helping to shift NICE, as I've explained, into a new type of NICE together.
Well, and you've gotten those sweet sweaters, you know, that
That's
you
would. Right. Yeah, but it was our teams who produced those. So.
Okay.
We don't just have sweaters. We have shoes. We have everything. It's great.
Shoes? Really?
Yeah, I'm not wearing them right now, but yeah, we have nice Cognigy shoes as well.
Wow. That's quite the branding. I like it. Well, if let's shift a little bit into the offering and what you're doing, because I also find that interesting. And As I said before, I'm really not that knowledgeable when we're talking about these things. And probably out of everyone listening, I'm probably the least. So when I kind of sit down, I start researching into what you do, into what your Cognigy does. I'm seeing it's AI and customer service, right? That's kind of the big umbrella term that I'm looking at. And I'm imagining that myself and probably others out there, you kind of see that, you read that, you think of a chatbot, you know?
Yeah.
And I was hoping you could maybe explain that difference to myself, really, as much as anybody listening. Just what is the difference between what Cognigy, nice Cognigy does, and what a chatbot would do?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And the reason why you're asking it is because there really is no clear definition. A lot of it is marketing terms, right? So at the beginning, it wasn't even called chatbots. It was like virtual assistants or virtual AI assistants or digital assistants and then chatbots and voice bots. And then no one wanted to use the word chatbot because everyone hated chatbots, including myself, actually, because most of the experiences weren't great. So the reason why you associate chatbots with AI and customer service is because this is the modality that you've experienced most, right? Yeah. You're on a website, you have a little thingy, it pops up, and then you can talk to it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So that is because building chat-based interactions is a lot easier than building voice-based interactions because the tech stack is smaller. Like with text, so you have a little chat widget. The text goes to Cognigy, we can process the text and we send new text out. So we'll talk about the processing in a second. Now with voice, you have more components to the stack. So firstly, you need real-time voice connectivity. Then the voice needs to be, depending on what you're using, but in the traditional setup, the voice had to then be transcribed into text. The text would then go to Cognigy. Cognigy would answer something. That text would then have to be rendered as audio again and output. So it's harder to do that. When we started the company, we actually started it as a voice AI company, but we felt very quickly that voice AI on the phone lines wasn't really feasible at the time. The latency was too high, the fluency just wasn't there. So we went mostly into chat. We still kept doing a bit of voice. But then we came full on back to voice. So now the majority of automations we're doing are actually voice automations on the phone lines. So AI agents in customer experience are really AI constructs similar to a ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever, but that are CX specific. Okay, they have knowledge. They have company specific knowledge. They have access to company specific APIs. So the thing about agentic AI that we are offering now and that we have been offering for the past couple of years is that where chatbots mostly just gave you an answer and maybe directed you to go somewhere on the website, agentic AI can actually do stuff, right? It can make a plan. So let's say you come in, you say, okay, I was going to go on a flight next week, but unfortunately I can't make it. Let's say you're not authenticated. Okay. Maybe a chatbot would say, oh, to change your flight, here's an article of how to log in and change your flight. Whereas agentic AI would make a plan and would go like, okay, so firstly, we need to know who he is. So we're going to authenticate him. And then once we have authenticated him, we're going to look at the flights. If there's only one flight, we assume it's that one. But if there's several, we need to have him pick. And then we need to confirm, is that the one that you want to change, etc. So agentic AI can make this plan and can then start interacting with you in multiple turns, so the multi-turn conversation, and then resolving your issue. So it goes like, okay, what's your last name, blah, 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 what's your booking code? And then you go like, what's a booking code? And maybe it sends you a little example of what a booking code looks like. And then you go like, oh, okay, it's ABC. And then it says, oh, no, sorry, it needs to be 6 alphanumeric characters. Ah, yeah, here it is, A1, B2, C3. Okay. Then it actually communicates with the backend APIs and goes like, yeah, looks correct. He said, let's say it's a voice conversation. He said his name is Schmidt. So we transcribed that as Schmidt, S-H-M-I-T. But the booking actually says S-C-H-M-I-D-T, but it's still the same. I've probably transcribed this incorrectly, right? So it's a lot more flexible in this new agentic world. So it understands, it plans, it reasons, and then it executes the plan just it's in the past, it was a very poor simulation of human behavior, whereas now it's an excellent simulation. That, and you can really think about it. Imagine you work in a call center and I need to be able to change my flight. So what am I going to teach you as the human contact center operator? I'm going to tell you, okay, here's a booklet of stuff you need to know. And this is the process if someone wants to change their flight. And these are the three systems you use to do that. So it's exactly the same thing, right? But now with these modern AI systems, they can actually then figure that out and they can dynamically adapt the plans if something doesn't work out, right? And so that's it's really a completely new world that we are experiencing with AI, not just in customer experience, but really everywhere in the enterprise.
Okay. And what are you talking about here, this example you put of the call centers? That makes me think that I think is always an important question, especially when we're talking about any enterprise implementation of any technology, right? Is the human element, because, you know, you're talking about that it used to be and you still can call and talk to a human being. So I want to hear your thoughts here. What if someone asks you, well, is this just replacing people's jobs? It's because that's got to be a worry and that's got to be maybe a tension that you must encounter.
Sure. And I mean, I'm always a friend of open words around this. This AI technology, not just in CX, but everywhere, is going to be massively disruptive to many jobs. This is true. This is in legal. This is in software engineering. This is in marketing. This is everywhere. Having said that, are we really going to replace humans at scale? This is something we have not seen in customer experience. And why is that? When you look at call volumes over time, call volumes are not decreasing because of the use of AI. Call volumes are actually increasing. So people are calling customer service more or contacting customer service more each year. Yet at the same time, the number of human agents that are available to do the job, that's actually not increasing, right? It's not a great job. I mean, you sit there and you get 200 people call you because they want to change their password, right? That's not great. So what we're seeing is agentic AI take the brunt of that work so that the cases that actually come through to the humans are the ones that actually need a human touch. Those can be cases that need a special kind of empathy, right? Or maybe there are regulatory reasons why a human needs to be involved. So for example, we have a customer, they're doing insurance sales and the AI can do everything, as in pre-qualify the customer, present the customer with options, et cetera, but the AI is legally not allowed to close the deal, right? So in the end, we're then passing it over to a human. The human asks another couple of questions and this is a salesperson. But now think about it. This salesperson in the past spoke to 10 people a day and 2 people bought something. Now this salesperson can speak to 10 people a day and everyone will buy because they already went through the whole pre-qualification process, et cetera. The AI did that, right? Mm. We also have, of course, this problem of peak load. So take airlines. Airlines have a very peak-heavy business in customer service. So let's take the situation we have right now in the Middle East. Contact center lines are red hot at the moment, right? Everyone's calling the call centers. Like the flights are not going through Saudi or whatever. Everyone's having problems with that. There are not enough human operators to take all of that, to satisfy all of that demand. So AI really is the only way to do that, right? So we see that at some of the largest airlines in the world. Let's say you have a base load of 200 people talking to your human agents. And then something happens, like maybe a winter storm or maybe a strike or something like that. And then this volume skyrockets from 200 concurrent calls to 20,000 concurrent calls within 5 minutes. Because if one person calls in, everyone's calling in because everyone has the same problem, right? Mm-hmm. And there are not enough human operators to take that load. So it's AI that's taking that load. So it really is more about increasing customer satisfaction, helping the customers quicker, rather than going this very down this very simple route of AI efficiency equals cost savings, because that is really not true. And it's not something we're seeing in the market. So it's not like our customers have reduced even though they have sometimes 80% automation rates, we're not seeing workforce reductions of 80%. Mm-hmm. So I think humans will remain very, very much needed. Mm-hmm. But AI makes it easier for customers to actually reach a human, because not every human now needs to talk to an AI. So the ones that actually do need to talk to a human can actually get through.
And as someone who's been involved with this for a while now, I'm curious to hear, is there something you feel agentic AI kind of falls short on? Now, this can be something that that everybody in the industry is working to remedy. Maybe it's something that it is only essentially human, and agentic AI could never hope to even try to emulate.
I'm sure we can come up with some examples of where agentic AI falls short at this point. Mm. Many of these are more on the humorous nature. Like, there was always this thing, yeah, agentic AI can't count the R's in strawberry, correct?
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. What does it mean? I mean, it's a joke that's created to make us think we are still superior. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, agentic AI right now with the newer models, Opus 4.6 models, etc., they outsmart 95% of all humans at this point already. The speed at which they operate is 1,000 times faster than what any human could operate on right now already. So anything that agentic AI cannot do right now, they will be able to do in the future. Now, of course, this pertains mainly to the digital world. So anything we can use a computer for, agentic AI will be able to eventually do. But there are things that I think are safe, right? So there's a lot of things in the physical world that, like, or even what we're doing here, right? I don't think I would have the same type of conversation with an AI avatar. Like, it would be weird, right? It's a human interaction thing. We want to do that. Or let's say I want to buy something from you. I think I would act completely different to you as a human than I would if I knew that you were an AI, right? So sure. I think in those cases, humans are still very much needed. Also, all other empathetic jobs, kindergartners, teachers, nurses, doctors, everyone will be supported through AI, sure. But I think asking the question, are there things that AI agents can't do? It's a valid question, but let's not forget, ChatGPT was released in November, I believe in November, so late 22. Mm. That's 3.5 years ago. Three and a half years ago, you could not have a real conversation with a computer. You could not have a voice conversation with a computer. You could not have a computer generate completely lifelike videos and pictures. All of this happened in the last 3.5 years. Only 3.5 years. Now let's go 20 years into the future. It's going to be very different from now.
Yeah. You know, I don't mean to sidetrack, but I think it adds to your point here that if you're taking journalism and what we do here, there was at the moment ChatGPT came out, everyone said, oh, that's it for journalists. They're on their way out. They'll never be, you know, there's no use for them anymore. Here we have a tool that can do what they do quicker, faster, can do the research, all those things. And yet we're all still here. And exactly. I think it's to your point that we've seen that while you can have PR news wires, things that are written automatically for anything, people don't really want to read that. And it's the exactly. human element. It's the tinge that we add to things that makes it authentic and interesting to read, and not just fact. And kind of like a blurb.
And the reason for that, I think, is because when we ask the question, like, okay, ChatGPT comes out, it can generate texts. So we go like, okay, journalists are doomed, right? Mm-hmm. But then they're not. And why is that? It's because we've changed. Like, we as humans expect something else. Like, there's this whole talk about AI slob, right? Half of the videos you see on TikTok or Instagram or whatever are AI generated. And by now, if you know it's AI generated, you just swipe it away, right? You don't want to see it. And so it's very similar with the Turing test, right? The Turing test was developed to see if a computer could fool a human thinking that it's another human. And of course, the Turing test will never be passed. And why is that? It is because our expectation, our knowledge is changing together with the capabilities of computers. So what does that mean? I could take a chatbot from 1995, like a really bad chatbot. And if I have someone from the 1950s talk to that chatbot, they're going to go like, that's a human. Computers can't do that, right? If I take ChatGPT advanced voice mode and have someone from 1995 talk to that, they're going to go like, that's a human. Whereas we go like, nah, that's AI, right? So our expectation and our, I guess, way of measuring these things is adjusting together with how technology is evolving. And that's the same with journalism, and it's the same with movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I personally, I just recently rewatched an old movie, which was Terminator 2, very befitting the topic. And I really liked it, maybe because I'm a bit older, but because I felt that it's not just full of fancy animations and stuff like that. You know, these new movies, like let's say Transformers or whatever. I don't know how many Transformers there are, but they all blur together. They're all like one big CGI spectacle, right? And it's we're kind of getting sick of that. And I mean, are we really going to watch a full length movie that's solely generated by AI? Maybe, but also maybe not, right? So there is a hope, at least, that the human touch in things, whether it be works of journalists or art or movies or music, will actually count for something and elicit a different type of emotional response from us as humans.
Well, I hope so too, or else you might be chatting with a EU startups journalist in, for the next episode.
I can probably I'm not going to take that call. So you're
safe. Thank you. Out of respect, I like it. Right. Yeah. I want to thank you, Philip, for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. On this element of, you know, media and how AI is impacting, I could chat all day, but I think it's good to leave it there. And yes, I want to thank you very much for coming on.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you.